Hello, hello, Leah Pika here. Today's two guests are here to share their vulnerable experiences as people of color in the analytics field. Stay tuned to find out who's shedding much needed light on the Present Beyond Measure Show, episode 58.
Welcome to the Present Beyond Measure Show, a podcast at the intersection of analytics, data visualization, and presentation awesomeness. You'll learn the best tips, tools, and techniques for creating analytics visualizations and presentations that inspire data-driven decisions and move you forward. If you're ready to get your insights understood and acted upon, you're in the right place. And now your host, Leah Pika.
Hello, wonderful listener, and welcome to the 58th episode of the Present Beyond Measure Show, the only podcast at the intersection of presentation, data visualization, storytelling, and analytics. This is the place to be if you're ready to make maximum impact and create credibility through thoughtfully presented insights. Now, last episode, I promised you an interview with Marilee Yorchak of the Digital Analytics Association, and we're going to get to that one. But since recording that episode, I've been inspired to more deeply explore the issues fueling the unrest behind the George Floyd tragedy and Black Lives Matter. And after being inspired by all of the change enacted by this global uprising, I started reading a book called White Fragility. It is a very uncomfortable read, especially for whom the author calls, quote, white progressives who consider themselves friends of the Black community, but don't actually do anything to change the status quo because that status quo unknowingly serves us. This event has clued me in that police brutality and racism has been off my radar because of the invisible benefits provided by what is called white privilege. And at first, I was super reluctant to speak out on the Black Lives Matter movement, especially on social media or here, because I was afraid. I was afraid to expose my own white fragility and even afraid to misuse the words black or white. But then as I gained momentum and making phone calls to lawmakers, doing lots of self-education, and even doing a deep dive into the history of racism with my children, I realized that I would use this platform today to address the very real prejudice silently undermining diversity, inclusion, and equality in not only the digital analytics and tech field, but the world. Now, even though a part of me is afraid to take a stand and piss people off or be right in the line of fire, I've decided that my comfort is simply less important than working towards equality for people of color. This episode's theme was inspired by the following passage from White Fragility. If you stand close to a birdcage and press your face against the wires, your perception of the bars will disappear, and you will have an almost unobstructed view of the bird. If you turn your head to examine one wire of the cage closely, you will not be able to see the other wires. If your understanding of the cage is based on this myopic view, you may not understand why the bird doesn't just go around the single wire and fly away. You might even assume that the bird liked or chose its place in the cage. But if you step back and took a wider view, you would begin to see that the wires come together in an interlocking pattern, a pattern that works to hold the bird firmly in place. It now becomes clear that a network of systematically related barriers surrounds the bird. Taken individually, none of these barriers would be that difficult for the bird to get around, but because they interlock with each other, they thoroughly restrict the bird. While some birds may escape the cage, most will not, and certainly those that do escape will have to navigate many barriers that birds outside the cage do not. For me, that passage really encapsulates the part of white privilege that I've never seen before. So I've decided today to use this platform to reveal those hidden bars of the birdcage in the tech field and beyond, and invite two highly respected people of color in the digital analytics field. They're here to share their experiences and their best advice for how to collaborate and ally with the white community. This is by far the most intensely emotional and inspiring episode I've ever recorded. So let's get fun comfortable. All right, our first guest today on this doubleheader is an award-winning digital marketing executive, entrepreneur, and educator. As an assistant professor of marketing at Canisius College in Buffalo, she infuses critical thinking discussions about diversity and inclusion into her digital marketing and analytics courses. She's also an executive director on the Digital Analytics Association board, where she's currently co-chairing the DAA's Anti-Racism Committee. Our second guest is the founder and CEO of Zimana, an analytics firm that helps organizations achieve profitability improvements in marketing, web development, and business operations. He's contributed articles to CMS Wire, DM News, and Information Week, and he's also an associate editor of Business Book Reviews for Small Business Trends. He's currently working on his first R programming book, R for Business Analysis. Please help me welcome to the stage Mary Owusu and Pierre Du Bois. Thank you so much for being here, guys.
My pleasure.
So we've actually interacted in multiple different ways. Mary and I actually met in person at a DAA symposium in Philly. And Pierre and I have just been sort of online cronies. And this is the first time we've met in person. And I'm so excited because you're joining us for what is sure to be an enlightening and provocative conversation, especially considering that today is Juneteenth. So before we dive into the pressing topic at hand, I would love for each of you to just share your origin story. How did each of you fall into this wacky and wonderful world of digital analytics? Mary, maybe we can start with you.
It's a great question, Leah. My family immigrated to the United States back in 1992, and I was always interested in technologies. I remember even as a young girl being sort of drawn to any computer or technology type system, whether it was in the home or at school, and wanting to fix things that broke. Mm-hmm. Fast forward, I became an actual working professional and went into the field of marketing. And what happened is I just accidentally fell into the field of analytics because of a mistake I made on a client's campaign. You know, I really felt called to do digital marketing from my technical background as a kid. So I was already doing digital marketing, but the analytics piece was not a part of my responsibility until I accidentally blew a client's entire budget over a weekend doing paid search because I didn't cap the budget. And then all of a sudden I had to learn how to read and understand data really quickly. Mm-hmm. So I could demonstrate to the client that the results were not as bad as what they looked like at first. So that was my foray into analytics, you know, really understanding search data and helping to tell a story. And I've never looked back.
Oh man, that's a great story. A lot of us kind of fell in by accident.
Yes.
So Pierre, what about you?
I'm also one of those fallen type people. My background is a little bit varied. I was originally an automotive engineer. For 8 years, I worked at Ford Motor Company as a design and development engineer. Mm-hmm. Did my MBA, and I had this grand dream of being a VC and aiming and developing a venture capital firm that would help particularly small Black-owned businesses. Mm. And the way that I got to analytics was also accidental. I worked at a government contractor in Huntsville, Alabama. And at that time, there was a big question on whether or not with each contract, are people really looking at our website? And that introduced me to Google Analytics. And I really got into Google quite a bit, but wasn't sure if I could develop a business off of it. Fast forward to 2009, I moved to New York for a job with a marketing firm that was using analytics, but within 6 months they did layoffs. And I looked at my whole business plan and said, you know what, maybe there might be a shot still of doing analytics in here, despite the politics. So I started Zimana in 2009. We've been in business now for 11 years, and it's just been a very fun ride, to be honest with you. Very, very fun.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, you're definitely producing a lot of great content out there. I love to follow. So I'm really grateful that you guys joined today, and I want to sort of set the stage for this particular episode because it deviates from my normal data storytelling shtick. And it was really inspired by the events catalyzed by the death of George Floyd. And there's been something I've been observing in the world very different in terms of the uprising and the awareness that people are coming to where enough is enough. And I have to admit, you know, at first I was super reluctant to speak on the Black Lives Matter movement, especially on social media, because I was afraid. I was afraid to expose the cracks in my understanding of what racism is and even misuse the words black and white. And I realized this was because I hadn't really empowered myself with fluency on this subject. I hadn't really explored what the phrase white privilege meant. And as I'm learning now while reading this book, White Fragility, which I highly recommend, is that it's this invisible thing that's all around me that I don't see necessarily. And that status quo of this invisible thing being there doesn't inspire me to take any action to help break the status quo of inequality and police brutality and all of this. So I think it's really powerful to be able to use this platform to bring stories that seem completely alien to me because I just don't share the same experience. So I know when we talked earlier, we talked about some of the stories, you know, Mary, of you actually coming to America and what that experience was like. So I would love if you could share some of that.
You know, like I said earlier, my family came to the U.S. from Ghana in 1992. We were, from my perspective as a young girl, we were fine in Ghana. You know, we luckily were not refugees or anything like that. We came on our own accord. My father was coming to do his doctorate at the university. So we all came as a family of seven, five kids and two parents. My father came a couple months before the rest of us did. But as soon as we landed, something felt different. And when growing up in Ghana, we were just Ghanaians. We were not Black. Mm. So we didn't describe ourselves that way. We were just, you know, I'm from Ghana, or I'm from this region of Ghana, and you're from this other region, or I'm from this tribe, and you're from that tribe. There was no actual distinction of people by their skin color. Mm-hmm. But joining America and the American culture was immediately clear that we were different. We were stared at everywhere that we went. So in the airport was my first experience of feeling out of place. I was 11 at the time. I didn't really take that in too much. I just kind of, you know, just went on with life and ended up living a very different life than what we had in Ghana. We came to a situation where we were very poor in America. I'll just say it as bluntly as I can, that we all had to share a one bedroom house that was very, very small, and we had nothing. We walked everywhere. We had no car, no food. People were the reason that we survived. People stepping up and showing up with bags of food at our door, or showing up to drive us to different places. And it's the empathy of people that really helped us. And I'll just fast forward the story. I wish I had more time, but I'll just tell you that at some point during our early years, our parents both had to go back for immigration reasons. And so the five of us kids found ourselves raising each other.
Wow.
And that's when life got really hard. And when that happened, what I will say is that we had at that point been a very private family. We didn't say much to other people about what we were going through or things we were having trouble with, but people sensed it and they showed up when they knew we needed help. But when that happened, we were inclined as five children to sort of bottle it up and figure things out on our own, but we quickly realized we couldn't. And the reason why we realized we couldn't was because there were people who asked us how we were doing and cared enough to actually wait and listen to what we really had to say.
Wow.
There were people who had empathy. You see what I'm saying? There were people who had empathy. And those people didn't just say, oh, how are you guys? Oh, okay, good. And just kind of carry that top level conversation. Those people were willing to dig deeper with us and ask, so how are you getting home today? Okay, do you guys need a ride? I'll take you guys, you know, I'll drop, you know, those things, right? And that was the beginning of me realizing that the empathy of other people was a real catalyst to just, you know, social living, to being human, right?
Yeah.
And it's compassion. I think it's compassion and empathy, because you cannot be compassionate unless you start with having empathy for something. And that opened the doors. So it was because of people asking and helping us that we were able to be connected to the right attorneys or the right questions to ask or the right people to help us out. Wow. So that we all did not get deported as a group of five, you know? So growing up and taking that to now, what I'll tell you is that when I think about inclusion and diversity and going back to what's happening in America today, I feel very, very frustrated and very angry about what is happening within the Black communities across this nation. Mm. I am African. I came here as an immigrant, but it doesn't matter. If somebody sees me on the street and they decide my skin color is a problem, they don't care whether I was somebody who descended from slaves or whether I came from on my own accord. And honestly, it doesn't matter which group I fall into. The fact is, Black people as a whole are treated differently.
Yeah.
And I am hopeful, because I know when people have empathy, I know from my own story that that's when hope really happens. So I'm hopeful that with so many people now listening and wanting to learn, and like you said, Leah, you yourself wanting to be open and to listen, this is where it all begins, because that's when you can step into empathy, and that's when real action and real change happens.
Wow, that is a really powerful story, Mary. I'm feeling it everywhere. And, you know, I think that's a really good point, because I'm seeing a lot of judgment being flung across different factions where different beliefs around whose lives matter are coming up. And a lot of time and attention is being focused on proving one side is wrong rather than doing just what you're saying. And one of the most powerful parts of white fragility that I came across was right in the beginning, talked about identity politics and why so many whites don't get up and do something to help. And the idea is that if you can't identify with a particular cause, you aren't inspired to take action for it. So I'm an activist in other areas that I really truly identify with because they've affected my life and my family's life. So when I realized, I asked myself, how could I identify with this cause and become empathetic towards it? And I realized that I was a chronic bully sufferer. I was chronically bullied as a child. So the piece of me that felt like an outcast because of my real name sounded ridiculously different than everyone else's, I was like tortured on a daily basis for years and years and years in school. So I can identify with that piece that it feels wrong to be treated so differently and cast out like that. So even though my experience as white has been wildly different in many, many ways, I can still empathize with that piece of me that wanted someone to stand up for me. And that's the piece of me that can come forward now, you know, and with that. So really beautiful. And
yes.
Pierre, how about you? What comes up for you, has come up for you around the recent events?
I think it's a culmination of a lot of things historic that is, and I think why people are struggling with it is that policing is a topic that there's a lot of vectors that go into it, a little bit more so than just racism. It's a system that we've never had as a country, we've never had to grapple with nationally. If you ever go back and look at anything, even going back to like back in the day we've had more video recording police brutality now, particularly in the last few years.
Right.
I think, and Floyd was a particularly sharp case because Minneapolis has had a history that's been pretty bad. There was a case last year with a Black Muslim cop that was supposed to be a unifier for the community, who shot a white woman, if I remember correctly, and was actually incarcerated. And it was the right thing just on the surface, but it also left a bad taste in everybody's mouth who were activists in the area, because it felt like they had moved very quickly for this, where if you look at what happens with Breonna, for example, it's been days.
Oh, I see.
somebody. And that's been a big contention among Black people, is this whole idea that it's not even, it's what's happening in the justice system when somebody is arrested. It's it's not just, you know, it's a, and the problem is, as a nation, we really haven't grappled with it. And there's a lot of reasons why. Even if you go back to civil rights, we've had things that dealt with housing and with employment. But when it came to doing anything towards policing, it would have crossed lines with states' rights. And if anyone goes back and looks at civil rights, states' rights was the excuse that the opposition gave for not voting for the Civil Rights Act and everything else that came with it. And there wasn't enough. And the other part of it is, and I think this ties in with the data to some degree that we're trying to get to now, is that there wasn't a real mechanism to do something nationally at that time either. Today, if you look, even if you're looking at Trump's executive order, I know there's a lot of debate about it, having a database, a national database to track when an officer has been released is a big deal. Before, you did not have that. And so for Black people, it was always about knowing where to go, where not to go. The whole idea of a green book back in its day was about knowing where you can go, where you felt safe. And I think what's happened in the last, I think why it's so sharp now is that, I'll say for this for myself, going to analytics, it was a little difficult at some level to talk about race. And I think it's always going to be difficult in a corporate setting. But at the same time, I sort of had to hopscotch, always, and throughout my life, I always had to hopscotch around it. And let me explain what I mean by that. Your allies are important, and you need to be able to feel safe. But a lot of times, you're going to be in a situation, particularly in corporate, where you're not going to have an ally in the room. Your boss may not be an ally. I had an internship in Arizona where the supervisor that I had really was undermining me, in the and they were microaggressions. I've had microaggressions all my life. I've had very rare instances where somebody was very violent towards me, but I've had microaggressions that could have derailed my career. So I've always had to kind of watch what I document, what I do, watch what I do. And it's part of, it's woven in enough where you have to sort of think about, it's always, you never fool yourself into thinking that it's not always there at some level. And it's just a matter of, you know, what is your coping mechanism that you got to develop in order to manage it and move forward.
That's a really good point, Pierre, because I was talking with a girlfriend of mine how there's aspects of being a woman that are different than being a man, like our personal safety and being afraid to walk around at night and these things where we just take this on as a normal part of being a woman. And what I'm realizing is how many different aspects of our identity require something like that, you know, and you mentioned the word microaggression, which I think is an important word to understand, because for me, that's kind of how I want to move into the discussion around how is this issue still at large in the digital analytics and tech field. So could you help explain what a microaggression is?
Microaggression is literally just it's a small, minute thing that you do towards somebody that is very backhanded. I guess I'm going to give a really good example. When I taught a class recently, I had a couple of students that did not come and talk to me directly. They were upset with the class, but in a professional setting, you go and talk to the instructor. And despite my saying, yes, come talk to me and explain, you know, if you have something on your mind, three students didn't come and talk to me directly. And one actually came back eventually, but two definitely were not talking to me. In fact, one walked out of the class. And then when I caught up to her, she had wrote this very kind of sarcastic or sassy note saying that, oh, I explained these things to you, when clearly she hadn't. So what microaggression is, it's those sort of situations where it's not overt racism. You won't see slurs, you won't see violence, but they're the things that lead into that, basically. And a lot of times in situations for Black people, for whether you're Black, Hispanic, and women see the same thing too in some ways too, it's these little things that are sort of like the birds or the canary in the coal mine. They're the little things that you're seeing that will make you question something, basically. And the challenge becomes, it can vary from individual to individual. Some, there are some people that feel like, okay, well, that's just part of the game or what have you. And there's other people who are more woke, so to speak, and say, hey, I'm not going to have it. And I think what's happened now, tying into George Floyd, is that I think we, particularly after having a black president or a biracial mm-hmm. president, I even have a friend of mine, we debated this quite a bit, actually. But I think, you know, no matter what, despite having a person of color lead the country successfully for 8 years, and despite more video that has been recording more and more, I think what we have on social media is, in social media, there's a sharper discussion now. You can see a lot of different groups of people coming out and talking, and the conversations are more raw, mm-hmm. where if you go back to civil rights, you always had famous people having to speak up because they were the faces that, forgive me, for somebody white would literally see. So the challenge becomes, I think now people are now sharing more than microaggressions, and I think it's there's a latency that's come up because of that. Mm. So.
Good point. It's kind of like I said, it's this invisible force field that many of us don't even see because it's so deeply ingrained into how we behave and we adopt our previous generation's behavior. And I'm really appreciating the level of awareness that I'm gaining through this, but also all around and the internet. And I know, Mary, you had mentioned a few instances where you had sensed microaggressions too, where I really stopped and thought about how people are treated differently professionally. I would love for you to share.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, and I completely agree with Pierre. I mean, I have certainly felt microaggressions or seen them or been on the other end of them. But I also want to say that sometimes the aggressions are not so micro, right. And sometimes they are quite. Sometimes they are quite deliberate, right? Sometimes they're macro aggressions, right? And we in the analytics world, we're very used to using the terms micro and macro quite a lot. Yeah. And so sometimes they are these sort of flippant comments that people make in your presence, and they may be intentional or unintentional, but they are derogatory nonetheless. You know, and sometimes they're just outright racist statements.
Yeah.
I'll tell you, earlier in my career, I was working for a company that was headquartered in Central Europe. And I had a high enough job role at the company that I was able to have a corporate car while I was abroad. And as I was driving from my hotel to the actual workplace, I was stopped by the police. And this was in Central Europe. Mm-hmm. And the only reason they stopped me was because I did not look like somebody who should be driving a corporate car. You know, they immediately assumed mm-hmm. that car with that company logo on it was maybe not supposed to be driven by somebody who looked like me. And so they pulled me over, had a lot of questions, made phone calls to confirm things. I was completely embarrassed. And I, to be honest with you, I'll share with you and your viewers that I was very, very mad.
Yeah.
And so in leaving, after they said, you may go, I just felt so disrespected that I'll tell you the truth, I gave them the finger. And I, as I drove away, and it felt good in the wind, I'll tell you, my finger felt really good in the wind. And fast forward, I finished my tour there, came back stateside, and within 2 weeks, I was fired from my job. And when HR called me in the room to do the firing, I remember going in and knowing, I had a feeling in my gut that I was going to be fired. And I remember they asked me one question and one question only, and that was, did I or did I not give the finger to the people abroad? And whether my answer, the answer to that question was the determining factor. So I was honest and I told them I did. And they handed over the papers they already had printed laying there to me to tell me that I was immediately terminated. And so that is very overt. And I wish that I had at that point done the things that maybe I could have done legally. But the reality is, this was at that point in my life, as I explained earlier, where I was having to really help take care of my younger siblings. And I could not be out of a job while I was fighting legal battle. I needed to quickly find a new job. And that's what I did. So that's one example that was, you know, very blatant and that I did not appreciate, to say it lightly, you know. But I'll tell you, in everyday life, as a Black woman, working in a field that is predominantly non-Black, predominantly white. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure Pierre can relate, and I'm sure a lot of Black people listening to this can relate, that you always feel left out in one way or the other. Mm. And it doesn't have to be overt, right? So for example, most companies don't observe a lot of the Black holidays. So if you have something due, you've got a big meeting, what are you going to do? You're going to show up. But at the same time, in the back of your head, you're dealing with something. You know you shouldn't be there. You know there's some discussions that you had with friends or some, you know, there's something deeper that you're dealing with that day, but you're shutting it down in order to just pay attention. And you feel like there's nobody you can talk to about that. You know, like, I'd really like to finish this meeting early so I can go and join the Juneteenth parade. You can't really say that easily to the white colleague next to you, where they'll just understand it, right? And I mean, it's just it's just really hard. And not just me, Leah. I mean, I've had my my husband has been terminated from a job for two white men going and saying he did something, and management not caring enough to really ask him if it was true or not. And just actually, they asked him if it was true or not, but it didn't matter what he said, honestly. And those things are really bothersome, and that is a very light word I'm using.
Thank you, because this is a clean rated show, but exactly, I can feel what's there.
Yeah, sure. It's all the time, and Pierre, I'm sure you can relate to some not so microaggressions in your life as well, just trying to make your way through corporate America and trying to keep down the fact that there are all these things in the back of your head every time you sit across a table from someone who doesn't quite understand the Black plight.
I would say, if I can jump in too, yeah. I think the challenge has been, you also have to pick your fights too, yeah. as well, is a problem, because
yes.
if you're, like I said earlier, if your allies are not where, I don't want to make it sound like a war, but it can feel like a war sometimes, if your allies are yeah. not really where, or if they're not sitting in the room or as a mentor or somebody that might have a line of discussion that might change your fate a little bit, it does become hard. When I did when I had an internship with Intel, this is about 2005, I had a supervisor that we were not getting along. And what he would do was he gave me a project, but he would ding me for asking questions, even though he was the one that understood the data behind it and the structure behind it. So it was basically this sort of catch-22. Mm. And as a Black person, if you don't have everybody around you, you sort of sometimes wonder if it's yourself. And sometimes blame yourself a little bit, but I had a very nice, she was biracial. She and I were the only minorities in the internship program. Mm-hmm. So I was the only like Black man. She was only Black woman. And she pulled me aside and said, you know, Pierre, I just from a little bit, you're telling me, yeah, there's a problem. She was the one that kind of reminded me and said, okay, yeah, this is, she had enough sight to say, Pierre, from what you're telling me and from what I'm seeing from, we had a kind of a mid-cycle review. She said it was enough for me. She said, yeah, this is, she helped me to understand that I wasn't alone in this and that, yeah, there was something there. The sad part was I didn't get the internship. It ended up, you know, I got the internship, but didn't get the full-time job next year. Brought it up to the supervisor, didn't do much of anything. Mm-hmm. But it was one of those things where the best you can do at that point was to move on. And unfortunately, that happens for a lot of people, which it makes it tougher because then it's about how do you make it better for the next generation that's right. coming up? How do you make it better for the people that come behind you as well? And I can say for entrepreneurship, the tough part is that if you're dealing with small businesses and what have you, you don't even have a corporate structure where you can move to another department or move to someplace else. That way it doesn't kill you. So you have to be very picky about. And I'm not saying I look at somebody, I have like this laundry list, my big one for a client, but right. you have to look at, you know, how well are they, is it a client that has enough empathy to what Mary's saying? Are they engaging with you? That's kind of how you work around the microaggressions, or at least can determine if it's A, somebody who is very bigoted, they're not going to work with you, B, somebody who is somewhat friendly and they might be just doing something by accident and just might need structure or wording, which kind of gets into things like where white frailty comes into play.
Or
C, somebody who really can be an ally and maybe somebody you can really build a genuine relationship with, whether it's professional, personal, or whatever it is that you're doing in your life.
Okay.
You know, it's making me think, like, this is a major blind spot. I know what I'm realizing is that as a person with white privilege, I have had major blind spots where I just don't see. I just don't see if I'm acting differently or how people are acting differently. And one of these, I think, blind spots is this idea that you're sacrificing a sense of justice, whether it's getting fired for, you know, like just even being pulled over and treated differently just for being who you are. You know, there should have been justice in that, and having people have your back, but having to sacrifice any sort of justice to maintain survival, this is a big thing that I think a lot of people don't understand, that you just stay quiet and you just move on, like you said, just to make sure you can keep going, move on to the next thing, and keep your family fed. And God, that is just heartbreaking for me.
Yeah, well, you know what, Leah, I'll just mention, I mean, it's not unlike when you were talking about your own childhood experiences, you know. Yeah. I think Black people collectively, we are, the way that we feel is akin to somebody who's been abused.
Yeah.
Right? For years, you were told certain things. You have emotions that you've bottled up that you couldn't express. Things kept happening. You kept having to just tuck them away. Because there are many things that for generations and generations, our great-grandparents and those that came before them, et cetera, all the way up to the first slave person that was brought here. Yeah. You know, there are things that you just couldn't say. You know, you were told to shut up and do the work. And, you know, and no, and even when you defied that and built Tulsa, you know, a big economic boom, right? You were told to shut up directly by them burning down what you built.
Yeah.
Right. It wasn't shut up in the be quiet, you know, case. It was more like shut up and we will shut you up. Mm-hmm. So over the years as an abused person, you have a lot of scars, right? So for those of us now in 2020, even though I'm talking to you now in 2020, I'm talking to you from the perspective of the things that I've heard, the things that I have seen other people in my circles experience, the things that were experienced by my parents and people who I've talked to, their grandparents, the people who lived here, people who are African-American themselves, since I'm not, like things that they've told me about what happened when what their grandparents told them, what their great-grandparents, all these stories, Leah, they're just scars, right? And so that's the thing. And so now the hope is that at least as a nation, there's conversation about this. And there is also, to your point, like eyes are open. There is hope now. Hopefully, this will actually lead to real change and it doesn't just die down after some time, right?
Yes,
so we're hopeful.
Exactly. Well, yes, hope is very important. I do feel a sort of sea change happening right now for me, for many others. You know, even some of the blind spots that you had mentioned earlier when we talked before around how candidates were treated differently. I think that's an important story to share too, because I want to use that to actually segue into what I think is going to be kind of the important part of this, which is creating allies, finding would-be allies and turning them into that. So would you mind sharing that story? Because I thought it was powerful.
Well, I'll say that I'm sure some other people can relate to this story, but sometimes microaggressions happen in the hiring process. And if you're not someone who is Black, sometimes you don't necessarily notice them. And
right.
So I was in a situation where the company I was working for had multiple locations. And in one particular location or office, they had in the past hired someone, a Black person who was not a great writer. And so that office had made the request of HR to make sure that anybody that tried to apply for a job with that title, let's just make something up. Let's say it was a project manager title. So anybody that was a project manager trying to be hired for that position, that person should be asked to supply a writing sample. Mm-hmm. So then what happened is HR continued to hire in the other locations and other offices without requesting a writing sample. I don't know how it fell through the cracks, but people were hired for this role across other offices without a writing sample being asked. Then, of course, you can probably see where the story is going.
Yeah.
The office that requested the writing sample gets a Black candidate who applies and requests a writing sample to be asked of this person. And I'm in a meeting, I'm listening because I was a part of trying to get hirings for my team. And so I was a part of a group that met to talk about how we were doing with candidates and moving them through the pipeline. And I hear that we're asking a candidate to supply a writing sample. And as I'm looking at her resume, I can see from her name and how she describes the things she's involved in that she's Black, a Black candidate. So I asked the question, who else applying for a project management role have we asked for a writing sample? And the answer is none. Mm. And I say immediately, this is setting you up for a lawsuit. Mm. Because what you're not noticing in your blind spot is that you are actually on paper asking one person to supply a writing sample, and that person happens to be Black. So unless this is institutionalized, unless the person that you hired 2 days ago for the same title was asked for the same requirements,
yeah,
then you should not put this on this sole Black applicant. And so and that's one example, Leah, but I'm telling you, it happens all the time where people are just blind to the fact that what you're doing is actually bias. It's right. Bias, and it's not okay.
Discrimination. Yeah, you know, it's interesting you talked about the institutional aspect, whereas one of the tripwires I discovered in this process, and White Fragility nails this right out of the gate, is as a person who feels that they're a friend to people of color, that I don't want to be seen as a racist. And the book breaks down this really interesting way of looking at the individual levels of taking action on your particular bias versus the institutional aspect. Whereas you might have a prejudice, all humans have these prejudices where they collectively create stories and pass them down about how people are different from each other and all these different aspects, but it's internalized. And then there's discrimination where there's that outward action. These are the microaggressions and whatnot against one on an individual basis. But racism, to the author, is this institutionalized aspect. It's a collective system. It's the government. It's income inequality. It's, you know, police brutality. Those are the systemic evidence of how discrimination is an accepted part of culture in this country. And I think that understanding those differences are really, really important. So, you know, I'd love to turn to Pierre and ask both of you, you know, as a white person, I definitely want to not trip anyone's wires. I want to say the right thing. I have the highest intentions. I want to help. But I know that I and people like me can be afraid of pissing people off even more than they already are, rightfully so. So what are some ways that, you know, would-be allies who have a lot of power and they don't know it to galvanize and stand up and start working together?
I think one part of it is, I'll share.
Yes, please.
And this is something I had to really think about a little bit. And I see it more as an asterisk to throw in there as well, too. I think it's about doing a lot of reading and soul searching. I think that's one part of it. Mm-hmm. And the reason why I bring that up is that we treat racism as some sort of personal thing. Like, okay, I hate you, therefore it's a personal act that you do. But systemic racism is about all these pieces that are in place.
Right.
And so it's a larger picture. And a lot of times when I've seen these even on Twitter, people who've had this discussion on would you have a conversation with somebody. And some people, to be honest with you, want to have that conversation. Some people don't. And sometimes in corporate, or even as an entrepreneur, it may be somewhat limiting on the range you go. But I can tell you the thing that I found from an ally that was helpful was, you know, going back to empathy, going back to, you know, taking a strong interest in someone and just kind of thinking about, you know, if you present an opportunity, what's the, you know, or opportunity to work with somebody, you know, making sure that it's something that you generally would do, mm-hmm. for, you know, try to envision that, you know, that's for everybody in a lot of ways. Like for me, for example, I actually wrote in an article, you know, one of the tips I had was don't yell through your laptop. And it was kind of hard. But part of the reason why, I'll share with you why a little bit, it's as a guy, as a male, the one thing you don't want to sound like is you can sound creepy through the internet very easily if you're not careful. So I actually, I joked around with somebody. I actually said, you know, sliding in the DMs, and the person raised their eyebrow, and I was kind of like, oh, okay, that probably may not be the right thing to say. But what I did was, I tried to show that I understood, even if I make a slip up, I try to show that I understand that that slip up is not intentional. I always look at how people double down before I say something. And I'm sort of used to communicating to people through a Twitter, through Facebook, through even, you know, Skype and everything else that we use now. In fact, before we went remote, I've been remote. And so one of the things I learned is that, as you know, the way that I think the help that I think an ally can really help is look at the empathy, look at the engagement you have. I will also say, you know, in terms of you hear about the term about white guilt, make sure that when you do talk to somebody, it's great to kind of be aware, but sometimes it's also about opportunities as well, too. It's one of the challenges in the United States is that we have different percentages of there's like 14% African-American. It's you know, the Hispanic population is growing in percentage. But depending upon where you are, that percentage is not the same. I could go to Arizona, and it's like 4% African-American. Martinsville, Indiana, which had a very notorious racist background. There was a woman that in 1968 had disappeared. And there's been, and if I talk to anyone Black who came from Indiana and asked about Martinsville, you'll get a whole conversation. You'll probably get a bigger conversation with a glass of whiskey. So the idea is... today, they've been trying to make amends for that. They've been trying to make a little bit of outreach. But if you look at the population, it's still only one. It's not even 1% African-American. I had a friend of mine that was told that Martinsville was a suburb of Indianapolis. Spoiler alert, it's not. So, so the problem was, they were, and he was told that by a recruiter trying to bring him on board to a job. So it's a couple of things where there's a little bit of asymmetry in some of the history, and you'll see that when people talk about systemic racism. When the protesters went on the highways, highways were built and through communities that were of color at one point, but you had to live in Austin or Little Rock or New York to kind of see that history. If you're white and coming from Hebron, Indiana, or some other places in Indiana, you wouldn't have run into that. So there's a little bit of asymmetry that's in there. So I say this to say, be aware of that asymmetry, but don't let that limit you in your experiences. I would say look at how you engage with people when you're online. Look at the conversations. And then I would also say definitely do a lot of reading, because back in my day when I was a kid, I would probably say my answer now is a little different. I would still talk to someone. Don't get me wrong. But when I was a kid, there were books, but a lot of times these books were not as widely available or even searchable. Right. But on the internet now, they are more discoverable, and it's a little easier now to read something and come back and say, hey, I've read something and I'd like to ask a couple of questions if I could. And that might be an easy conversation to have. And I'll say this, even as an African-American, there was a time where I did a lot of reading on different books on Black culture, because sometimes for me, even though I've had my experiences, those books helped me to frame those experiences and make connections. So that way, when I do run into, let's say now, Mary, for example, that we're face-to-face and everything, we can connect and talk at a level that makes sense. Or with you, Leah, the idea that I'd like that you mentioned white frugality as well, because there was a couple things from that author I saw on the YouTube that connected. So it's a little more than just reading. It's more about having a baseline to have some sort of structure and conversation, basically. To your author's mention in the video, she mentioned about how some people can have that discussion on racism, and there's some people who can't have it still. Yeah. But I think having the, I think for allies, thinking about how you're aware and how you're connecting with people, don't try to knock out the ballpark in the first day. It's not happening. Right. If it did, I don't think we'd be having this conversation.
Right, right.
But I think understanding the history of things helps you to kind of frame it a little bit, and may help you a little bit in terms of framing your own experiences as well, too.
You know, all this is a great point in terms of looking at how you're engaging online. And I think, you know, one of the distinctions the author makes, because I started getting very uncomfortable with this feeling, because I was thinking, this author is calling me a racist, and I've never identified with that word, because in my mind, I had a definition of a racist person as someone with clear outward discriminatory actions, white supremacists, Ku Klux Klan, people burning down churches, like really obvious acts. So she said, if that's your definition, take a deep breath. That's not what I'm saying here. We're going to retool your definition of racism, not as you being a person being out there doing these very discriminatory things, but you participating passively in a systemic status quo of behaviors of inequality. And I think if people begin to start to relax that these uncomfortable dialogues and books and movies aren't necessarily going to point the finger at them and say, yeah, well, you're a racist, then I think people are going to start to soften and become more curious rather than being on the defensive, because that is the essence of white fragility. This like, oh, I don't want to be attacked because I'm not like that. I'm not like them, you know, and I think it's a really valuable process. And I don't know, Mary, what do you think too? Have you seen people make that evolution successfully? You know, what's inspired that?
You know, I think it's hard to know if people have made that evolution successfully because so much of that is internal to that person. But I will say that I've seen some outward signs that give me, again, hope that I think we're moving in the right direction. I am a part of a membership group online, and the leader of this group is based in Canada, has a beautiful family, and happens to have, as a part of his family, he has adopted a boy from Kenya. And he's fond of this boy, loves him as much as he loves his daughter. And in this, he always talks about his kids, sometimes even shows them in his live videos. And one time he was talking to the kids and happened to refer to both kids as monkeys as he was doing that, right? Oh, you monkey and this and that, right? That was one thing. And then the other thing that happened was he actually referred to his son as colored, my colored son. And he said it very obliviously. He did not, in that moment, you could tell if you were someone who knows about using words like monkey and colored, you could tell that he didn't know better. You just could tell. And so what he did was, somebody called him out, by the way. A black person said, you know, this is uncalled for, and she really was angry. Oh, wow. And it spurred a need for a discussion. And he put on a live session where he had raw conversations with three individuals that kind of told him their perspective on the things that he said and what he did. And I saw it happen in real life. A person who was in front of me starting to realize that they have been wrong and that they have been racist to some of the closest people in their lives.
The light bulb went off.
Wow. The light bulb went off, Leah. So sometimes you can see it happening and sometimes you can't. And so what I will say is that I think some of the things that are going to be really helpful for my white brothers and sisters that are trying to go through this journey together, I couldn't agree more with Pierre about just educating yourself, because education is very personal and not everybody is ready to read White Fragility.
Yeah.
Right. You know, but there's a resource that I'm happy to share with your listeners, Leah. It's called something, it's just a Google Doc, and that somebody's adding to and other people are collaborating on. It's called the Scaffolding Anti-Racism Resources. Right. So just, it helps. It meets you where you are. So if your mental position is, you know, I don't see color, these are the books and the resources you used to look at. If your mental position is, I feel guilty for being white, this is where you go, right? That kind of thing. So that's also an incredibly helpful thing. And I'll just add one more thing, that ultimately this is all a very personal journey. So I encourage, again, my white brothers and sisters to just commit to changing one thing about what you are thinking, one thing about what you're feeling, one thing about what you are doing. Yeah. So what is one thing that you think that you could start to shift? And it's very introspective, very personal. You know, is there something when you think about when you see a Black person getting shot or when you saw Black people getting shot 3 years ago, why you didn't do anything? What was the thought?
Yeah.
Why didn't you do anything then? And what can you do to change? What are some small things you can do to start changing those things that you think? As far as some small things you can do, maybe go for a jog in that neighborhood that you have avoided your whole life. Right? And see what that feels like. Just, you know, or volunteer at an inner city school once a month.
Yeah.
And just be there as, you know, a helper that helps with the kindergarten class or something that doesn't require anything. You know what I'm saying? Just see what these kids are coming to school with, even as young as they are. And just humble yourself, because one thing that you can change about what you're doing, feeling, or thinking could make all the difference for a whole group of people.
That is so powerful, Mary, because what I don't think each individual person realizes, especially myself, is that each of us can be like dropping a pebble into a pond. It feels like a tiny drop that maybe no one else hears, but there's this ripple that each of us has because we inevitably bump into these other atoms in our journey.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've been trying to think like, what can I do to ease myself in to this process? So I've been making calls every single day to my state's lawmakers to support acts like the Justice in Policing Act of 2020 and demilitarizing the police. And there's
Excellent.
This app that makes it so easy to do this. It's a no-brainer. It's called Five Calls. And it just gives you all of the bills that are up for reform and tells you exactly what to say and the number. And like, it takes all the guesswork out. And I've now
Yes.
been really excited about doing that. But I would actually love to riff for a second and share a story where you talked about, you know, talking to children and seeing what that's like, and also, you know, affecting the future generations, like you said. So for me, I think that's been, parenting for me has been the greatest spiritual experience of growth that I've ever been handed. And this was an area where I normally have broken down so many standard narratives for my children that they're able to question and see things with, you know, observer curiosity eyes. But this was a blind spot. I thought to myself, if I just act normal with everyone, then he's not going to pick up any negative biases or prejudice. That's my job. But what I decided to do is start researching, like, what kinds of books can we read at home? So we read a book called Train Your Dragon about diversity, which was really interesting. But we also watched this YouTube movie called Our Friend Martin. And it's all about the life of Martin Luther King Jr., but in a really kid-friendly format, like great storytelling. It was a cartoon. And it showed what would have happened if Martin Luther King had never given his big speech and become the force of good that he was in the world, and what our life would have been like today. And when my 7-year-old son saw how different treatment could have been if he hadn't existed, he was so confused. He was like, at the end, he said, "Why would anyone treat someone differently based on their skin color? That's so stupid, mommy." And like I literally shed a tear because I realized there was this vacuum of belief for him. And we as parents, I think, have the greatest power to eradicate this injustice for the future by filling that vacuum with a belief that we should just be created, not just be created equal, not only created equal, but treated equally.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. It's absolutely up to us, because when you leave that vacuum open, it's then available for anyone else to fill it with hatred and bigotry and things you actually don't want your kids to fall into. And, you know, from the perspective of a Black mother with three Black sons, I'm fearful. That is the word that comes to my mind, because I don't want them to one day go from being cute, which is what they are right now, to being feared just because they grew up. Just because they grew up.
Wow.
That's it. That's it. My husband is 6'4" and, you know, bald and dark and chocolate and beautiful, you know. Let me just put it out there, ladies. And
you go, girl. Yeah.
And he steps out to go to the grocery store or wherever he's going, and I'm looking at the clock. Like, oh man, I hope he comes back and nothing happened, you know. And I fear that for my kids. And so I worry, and I'm trying to think of what I can do. And of course, so the situation that we're in, we're in a predominantly white neighborhood, and I want them to have a good education. That's why we're here. And here's the thing, like, this is one of the problems, by the way, what I just said, because good education should not only be available in predominantly white neighborhoods, right? But so here we are, and I worry that they might, as they grow up and start having crushes and all of those things that kids go through, they're going to like, you know, Becky or Melissa or, you know, somebody. And then, you know, Becky or Melissa's mom or dad are not going to appreciate that. And next thing you know, they're in a really bad situation. I don't want that for my boys.
Oh, man.
So if they're too young for me to talk about, you can't like so-and-so person. And to be honest, I shouldn't have to have that conversation with my kids. And I don't plan to tell them who they can and cannot date. But I do have to have a talk with them about how they should be careful, how they can't go where their friends are going, how they should watch their back a little more. And they should ask certain questions before they enter somebody's home or join a party or what have you. I know it's coming up, you know? And so what am I doing? I'm trying to educate them on the things that are age appropriate right now, which are, we have talked about Martin Luther King. We have talked about, you know, there was a time when things were different for Black people versus white people. And I'm doing my best to challenge the schools to make sure that the textbooks that are being in the, that being used in the schools are the ones that actually tell the truth, right? The ones that don't just say, you know, Africans were brought here as workers and the plantation life was a happy life. There are textbooks that say these things.
Oh gosh.
So I'm investing in those things, right? Making sure that the schools that I am, that I'm just paying attention to the teachers and whatever they're teaching in the classroom. I look at everything that comes home, and I stay in close touch with the teachers, and I volunteer myself to go to the school if they need somebody to come in and speak on things from my perspective.
Yeah. And I think the helpful thing now is that people can talk a little bit faster. There were things that I had a friend of mine that unfortunately had passed away some years ago. And he actually told me some things about when we both went to the same high school, and we had a couple of good discussions. One was one friend who I won't name off the bat. I always had a good vibe from the family, but his experience was different because he tried to date, and the family was white, but his experience was different because he had tried to date the daughter in the family. So there were some things that, so for years I'm thinking, okay, well, this family is great. They're not bigoted. But from his perspective, it's different. And sometimes that does happen. I think the only good thing with technology right now is that people are having these dialogues a lot faster, as opposed to in my situation where, yeah, it happened, but now we're discovering this or hearing about this 20, 30 years later. I think that's what's happening. I think there's some good and bad that comes out of it, but I think the good part is that people can talk a lot quicker, faster, or talk about some issues a little bit quicker and faster and kind of get to a point where maybe it can help speed the dialogue a little bit. Again, that's what I think for everything for policing has happened. We've had video for a while, but the fact that video is being shared a little easier for people to galvanize and say, hey, we need to do something. And we're seeing that now. So,
you know, what I think is so powerful just about what we're doing here that I encourage anyone who's listening is listen, start asking the curious questions of people's experiences, start to see. This is for me all been all about lifting these goggles of like, oh, it's not still around. Everyone has a fair shot. Just kind of lifting these goggles up and going, oh man, like there is still a lot going on. And I just had no idea. And it's that realization that there's something really sinister still at play that at least has been the fire under me to say there's absolutely no reason why that should continue. So I am just so, you know, honored that you shared these experiences. And I wonder, Pierre, I think you had a couple of resources or books that, you know, people could look into to get themselves more acclimated to this.
I think, there's a couple of things that you can do. There's, and some of them, one of them I had in mind, this is one of my favorites, actually. It's a little, I'm going to apologize ahead of time. It was written by Dr. Henry Louis Gates back in the 90s, but I still think it's a good one. It's called 13 Ways of Looking at a Black Man. Mm-hmm. And it talks a little bit about, it's a little bit male-centered because of the title, obviously, but I still think if you're in leadership, you'll learn, it's about people in each 13 different situations, ranging from Harry Belafonte to Colin Powell. In each situation, someone is trying something as a leader, and then they had another man, another black man, where the relationship is strained. And what it talks a little, reason why it resonated with me quite a bit is that it's the idea that, you know, we've talked about, you know, black and white and, you know, white fragility. Even black people politically, they're still, even with the experiences we have, we still need to learn how can we support each other for a broader picture. And I think that's where a lot of the problems are. Sometimes people think of it as just themselves, but there's always a broader picture. So 13 Ways of Looking at a Black Man is very helpful. I do think looking at the documentary 13th,
if you have not seen it, that's next a must. On my list.
that's definitely a must because it talks about the history of, it talks about the prison complex and system. Mm-hmm. It does it over a very good timeline, and it shows how the systematic racism has kind of evolved, basically. And it's very important because a lot of times no one thinks about the police unless they're getting robbed, basically. Nobody thinks about that in a way. But I think what it will force us to do is start thinking about, you know, what are the laws that are being passed locally, mm-hmm. that we use for enforcement? How is our police positioned? Every town should be doing this now. Within context of data, towns have always talked about, you know, using technology and attracting, having an open portal and data and trying to come up with these services. Well, a lot of these services are also leading into transparency and accountability, which mm-hmm. ties into police services as well. So anything that deals with that will also tap you into the discussion a lot broader, I think, because you can start looking at those threads of how do we hold people accountable when something is happening? How do we know that things are getting done? A big part of the debate right now with police brutality is the fact that police are killing black people, whether it's transgender, women, mm-hmm. men, and the accountability is not there unless we are protesting. And that's not systematic. You cannot have a nation protesting all the time to get something.
Right. That is the inequality. And 13th is for sure on my list. My partner just watched it and clued me into the idea, which I had already had these ideas, that the prison system is being fed in a way by a system that is driven by profitability. And there's like so much beyond like feeding into that as well, where it's like, in order to enact change, you have to remove some of the most powerful forces, which is when it's based in money. So it's so much simpler than even like believing that everyone should be treated equally. So
it's complicated, Leah. Mm-hmm. It's complicated.
I want to add one more too. Also, I would say read about the experiences of the black people who have been successful. In the sense of, let me give you a good example. Like Earl Graves, he was the founder of Black Enterprise.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Forgive me, I know I was supposed to remember a book, but I cannot remember the name of the book. But he's
I'll
one
find
book.
It for the
I
notes.
I promise you that. It's one. He talked a lot about... It talked about how he started Black Enterprise, and there's also Johnson Publications as well. That's the one that owned Ebony, Jet Magazine, and everything growing up. Those are staples in the black household. There's not anyone, I'm 51, asking by 50, 60, 70, you know, and even a little bit younger, they'll know what Ebony and Jet is.
Of course. course.
Well, yeah. A lot of the times, Black Enterprise and also Johnson, with Ebony and Jet, they had to prove out to the advertising dollars that there is a market for their product among Black consumers. And this was in the 70s and the 80s.
Right.
That was something that had to be fought for. Where fast forward to today, you can look at Nielsen. They've done some excellent articles on culture and the impact, whether it's LGBT, whether it's or LGBT, apologize, or whether it's Hispanic or whether it's African American. But a lot of that gives you a little sense of history and a little sense of other things that were an influence, basically. Right. And I think having that, I think that helps in a racial discussion. Not having any sense of history starts to default to this, let's focus more on what my personal experience is. And while that might be valid to a point, it means you start missing out on certain discussions. I have a friend that was upset about why the protesters were marching on the highway. Well, that friend did not understand the significance of why the protesters were going on I-35 in Austin or 630 in Little. So you need to have historical some sort of historical
context
to kind of get it. And there are a lot of different books out here. When you read about even some of the people who've been very famous, you'll start getting bits and pieces of it. It kind of ties into the book I mentioned about 13 Ways of Looking at a Black Man, but it's the same type of thing. You kind of get some sense of what's consistently coming up, why these challenges exist, and how people may feel about it as well.
Wow, guys. Thank you for sharing that last one. And I have to say, this was one of the most invigorating, I think, inspiring conversations, probably the most that I've ever had on this show. And I'm just so honored about the transparency, the vulnerability that you shared with, and really, I can feel a lot of kindness going out to say, like, yes, let's work together. Let's make this a collaboration and just start listening to each other. So our time, unfortunately, has run out. But Mary, first, I would love to hear about what you're working on with the DAA currently, and also just whatever project has you most excited right now.
Absolutely. So first, can I just add that the apps that you mentioned, Leah, the Five Calls app is excellent. In addition, some other Black-oriented or justice-oriented apps are We Read Too, Liberate, Group Fit, and Winnow. And I'll give you all those links. Winnow is W-I-N-N-O. So I'll share those with you so your listeners can easily grab them.
Perfect.
So some of the things I'm working on, I'm on the board of the Digital Analytics Association, and we have very quickly commissioned a committee to work on how we can bring about some anti-racism efforts within the digital analytics community. And so if anyone wants to know more about this, we haven't yet gotten to a point where we have a web page up or anything like that, but we would love for you to get in touch with us anyway by emailing info@digitalanalyticsassociation.org. And we will make sure that you are in direct communication with us and that you're part of us coming up with a solution, because we can only get through this together, right? That's what we know. Mm-hmm. And as far as what I'm very excited to talk about, so after years of being in corporate America, starting my journey as a search marketer and going on to become an executive, a senior vice president at a marketing agency, I decided to run things on my own. I wanted to really do more to actually teach and connect with people one-on-one. So I'm a full-time professor now at a college, and I also work directly with businesses and marketers on search engine optimization.
Cool.
Specifically, I coach businesses and marketers on how to do SEO properly so they can get their message out there. I love being able to sit with people, get to know people, because when we see each other, when we have communication, guess what happens? Empathy happens. Those conversations, all of a sudden you start talking about personal life, and next thing you know, you've built a relationship with a stranger. So I just love that I'm now doing that, and I'm committed to my entrepreneurship path, and I'm loving it.
Awesome. Well, we can't wait to help support that journey.
Yeah, I forgot to even say where I am. So if you want to know about that, please, my website for that is gurubound.com. Like G-U-R-U bound, B-O-U-N-D.com.
Because
I want you to be guru bound.
That's awesome.
Work with me. Mm-hmm. So my absolute pleasure to share my my experience with you, Leah. This was excellent. Thank you for the opportunity.
Of course. Thank you, Mary. And Pierre, how can people catch up to you, and what are you working on?
Well, a couple of things. Right now, I'm still working on my book. And actually, I have another book that's coming out, but this was done with a group of small business owners called Faith, Failure, and Success. It's basically each chapter has each business owner's struggle. In my chapter, I talk a little bit more. I'm a little bit more pragmatic. It's a little bit more about how faith or how to be inspired in keeping yourself going. And what I wrote in my chapter, I talk a little bit more about ethics and about how that can play into knowing your choices and learning how to make the right and wrong choices, but how to avoid making the wrong choices, as I say. So that will be out this summer as well. And then on top of that, like I said, I was speaking last year until, of course, COVID took out pretty much every conference. But there is a conference coming up on Codepalooza, which is based in Louisville, Kentucky. And I will be speaking just same way we're doing here, pretty much long distance. That will be in August as well. So in the meantime, if anyone wants to get in contact with me, I'm available through Twitter. Zamana Analytics is my company. You can find us on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and we're open to working with businesses of all different types, ranging from small businesses that have some sort of need for Google Analytics to large, who has a lot of data. We need some sort of modeling in our programming. So that's my shameless plug.
I accept yours. I approve that plug. Well, guys, I'm just so honored and humbled that you took this time today to share and to encourage and to inspire. I'm indebted to you. And I know that I think people will also in turn be really inspired by the stories shared here today. And my hope of hopes is that if it just inspires one person to get up and start getting educated, start listening and taking action, then I'll be thrilled.
Well, I'm glad that we did this too. A lot of times I don't get, to be honest with you, I really do not get chances to talk about diversity as much as I would like to. And I think this is great that we're doing this. So.
Oh, wonderful. All right, guys. Well, it was amazing speaking to you, and I hope to run into you in person at the right time. Take care.
All right. Take care.
You know, when I created this show, I never conceived it would bring such an emotionally challenging experience for me so many years later. But as a public figure in this space, I feel a growing responsibility to leverage this platform to speak out on societal issues that need our collective help to enact change. Will you join me? I hope so. So to catch all of the links, resources, apps, everything mentioned in this episode, visit the show notes page at leahpica.com/058. I would really love to hear from you about how this issue is affecting you and any resources you have for helping push change forward. This is where we need to have the conversation. And if you love the show, please hop on over to iTunes to subscribe, leave a rating and review, which is so very appreciated. And I'll leave you with a bit of inspiration by Layala Saad. This quote is one I borrowed from an incredible LinkedIn post by my previous guest, Dominic Quartuccio, which he just published on the subject of anti-racism for leaders. And that is, here is a radical idea I would like you to understand. White silence is violence. It actively promotes the system. It says, I am okay with the way things are because they do not negatively affect me, and because I enjoy the benefits I receive. My take? Silence is violence hits right to the heart of this, and what I've learned throughout this process of unmasking the hidden dark side of white privilege. The goal of this episode was not to cast judgment, but to inspire, because the more people working at the same time to push down a wall of oppression, the faster it will fall. It's time. I am deeply regretful that it's taken me this long to take a stand, but I'm here now. and I stand with Black lives. Please stand with me. Namaste.